Welcome to the Citation Podcast. I'm Adrian Brine, Partnerships Manager here at Citation, and today we're lifting the lid on something that many veterinary practices find a little unnerving: HSE inspections. In a busy clinical environment where teams are juggling surgeries, consults, emergencies, and client expectations, the thought of a health and safety executive visit can feel like yet another pressure. I'm joined by three fantastic guests. First, we have Lucy Pottle, one of our health and safety experts here at Citation, who works closely with practices across the country. We're also joined by Chris White from the Veterinary Management Group, bringing the management and leadership perspective. And last but certainly not least, we've got Stephen Goodyear from SPIVS, who is also a practice owner, offering insight into the operational realities facing practice teams today. To set the scene, when we talk about HSE inspections in vet practices, the same concerns come up time and again: COSH, sharps and medicine safety, manual handling, PPE use, and properly maintaining equipment. These are often the pressure points that keep practice leaders awake at night. So why not start there? So, Lucy, from Citation, from your work on the ground, what do you see as the biggest health and safety challenges for practices right now?
I think the biggest challenge is probably balancing the busy clinical requirements with the requirements of health and safety. Most practices are not necessarily unsafe, but they are often very busy, which can lead to safety practices slipping. There's such a wide range of hazards that you need to control in the practices. You've got, like what Adrian said, sharps, chemicals, anaesthetic gases, COSH, manual handling. So keeping on top of all of those things, as well as things like staff training, risk assessments, SOPs, equipment maintenance, it seems a lot for practices. So I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges.
Fabulous. And Chris, Stephen, what are your members most concerned about when it comes to HSE expectations?
Well, listening to Lucy there, it was quite a list. So I think that sums it up really. It feels like a huge responsibility. Do you know enough as an individual? Do your team know enough? Are we doing enough across different teams and different sites particularly? Is it documented enough? Is it reviewed regularly enough? Is it actually being actioned? So if you look at human factors, then you have work as prescribed, which is your SOP, and we have lots of SOPs floating around practice, but then you have work as done, which may not bear any resemblance at all to what the SOP is telling you to do. So we have all of those, and as Lucy touched on there, time, capacity, competing priorities, and so on. It's very complex. Essentially, are we getting it right?
Great. Thank you, Chris. Stephen?
Yeah, very similar in terms of the list that you created, Lucy. A lot of it is, I think, merging what the regulations say with what is practical, with bringing the team on board. There's a lot of stuff that I think can be intimidating when you look at a big long list of checklists and creating systems that not only train people, but then show people that you've trained, and then show people that you show people that you've trained. So I think a lot of that is combining all those things together and taking someone like yourself's skills and saying, look, this is what is needed, this is what is practical, and this is the way to do it, and to do it in a way that you bring the whole team on board so that they don't view it as a sort of an undesired aspect of the business that they'd really rather not be, which fundamentally there's a lot of regulatory things that fits into that category. But to make it a lot more of, this is why we do it, this is the reason we could do it, and this is what is appropriate for the practice. And then there will be a proportion of that, which is a, this is also the exercise we have to do to prove for something like an HSE inspection. But on a day-to-day basis, make it a practical thing where you can say, this is what works for the practice, and it's fun, we enjoy it.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm now going to move on to look at HSE focus areas. So focus areas for regulators evolve quickly, and it can be hard for busy vet teams to keep pace. So Lucy, right now, what are HSE inspectors paying the most attention to when visiting veterinary practices, please?
The areas that we've discussed already, so COSH is a big one. So inspectors will be checking how practices are handling hazardous substances, everything from anaesthetic gases, drugs, even disinfectants are using in the prep rooms. They want to see that you've got proper COSH risk assessments, the right PPE available, and the staff have been trained in how they're used, and also that they're actually also that the basics are not only in place, but they are being implemented and they're being lived day to day. So like you said, work as planned and work as done. So is it being implemented? Other areas, things like SHARPS, clinical waste also get a lot of attention. So they're looking for correct waste segregation, safe disposal, secure storage. So anything like overfilled sharp bins or mixed waste streams would be a bit of a red flag because there's high potential for injury in those areas. And something also that's definitely grown in focus for the HSE is mental health and well-being. So inspectors now are looking at, along with the physical health of the staff, is the mental health. They'd be looking at whether the practice has done a stress risk assessment, what support is in place for the team. Because obviously it's well known within the industry that it can be stressful, high workload and emotional. So it's important to So it's important to protect the team's mental health as just as important as their physical health.
Great. And thank you, Lucy. And staying with you, Lucy, and staying on HSE focus areas, what themes or patterns are you seeing from the visits or feedback you're hearing about?
I think, like I said earlier, there's not a lack of willingness, and practices are trying really hard to be compliant. I think in the absence of a dedicated health and safety person, safe practices can slip. So documentation, COSH, risk assessments, manual handling risk assessments, they're areas that come up again and again from the visits and from our work on the advice line.
Lucy,
yeah.
So what sort of example, if as a practice owner, what sort of things would you see that we would be not we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing when we think it's really great, our sharps bins are all looking after? What sort of areas would an inspection would you see that would say, you're doing okay, but this is where you're letting yourself down on sharps or anaesthetic gases or something, as an example?
I would say if your sharps bins, often we see overfilled bins. So then that then means that the bins can't be emptied safely. There's a risk of needle stick injuries when you're emptying the bins, when you're handling the waste.
I need to prove that. So if it's the sort of thing when I'm walking, if you walk around my practice at the moment, would you look and say, no, that's great, all of the bins are fine? Or would an inspection or yourself want to go, actually show me what the bins were like last week or the month before or something like that? Is there extra documentation, things like that, that I might not be doing?
An inspection, on the face of it, it's an inspection. It's a point in time. So what we see on the day is that's what we're observing. Okay. But we want to see how is it managed. So is there an SOP? Is there a risk assessment for handling waste? What's your storage for the facilities for once you're removing the waste from the bin? Do you have cleaning schedules in place to show that you're emptying the bins regularly and they're not getting to a stage when they can be overfilled? So things like that we'd be looking at.
And that's what sort of written documentation to say, actually, I know you take the clinical waste and we usually put it here and we chuck it there and everybody knows it and then we store it there. But something that's written down that I can show you, or someone was to say, we will put it here and it does that.
Yeah.
Okay, super.
Fabulous. I'm going to move on to a new area now, and Stephen and Chris, I'll bring you guys back in here. So I'm going to look at managing risk without overwhelming staff. So one challenge we hear a lot from practice leaders is, even when the systems are good, the team can sometimes feel anxious about inspections or wary of doing something wrong. And that's what I want to explore with the both of you. So, Stephen, if I could start with you, please. How do practices bring their teams along on the safety journey so that people feel confident rather than fearful?
I think inevitably, when any sort of inspection, whether that's HSE or that practice stands or anything, there's always an element of you want to pass it. So I think there's going to be an element of anxiety. I think probably a big part of it tends to be to build it into the practice as an instrumental part of it, rather than attack on that once a year you have an inspection and Lucy comes along and ticks the forms. That probably involves making it really simple for the team, making it a bit fun for the team, making it so that it's not quite the when you start the business and you join the practice, you do your health and safety training and then never ever happens again. But something that's a little bit more of an ongoing process to go, right, you've developed this stage of your career, now we're going to learn about how we do the anaesthetic gases and how we, incorporate it into part of that. So when you're learning about anaesthetic circuits, we also teach them perhaps the health and safety side of it, rather than a single separate training day of health and safety, which might be less exciting, particularly if you're not interested in that as a clinical person. So I think part of it is, a large part of it is embedding it into the practice like we do with a lot of other aspects of our training, so that it's not a specific separate, dare I say it, sort of less, more regulatory, less exciting part, but just a part
that's embedded in the practice. And also part of it is to be able to show the team the point of it as well. So some of the stuff like manual lifting, if it's an SOP that sits on the wall, it can look like a bit of a tick exercise. You've got to do it. But if we can show it and demonstrate it and use it every day and show that the reason is because, look at this, me, older man vet who's got a sore back because I've been doing it for 30 years. This is, you know, teaching younger vets how to do it, not just as a tick box exercise.
Yeah, I think that's really important, the culture. If the culture is like that within the practice and it's lived day to day, like we were saying, it's not just on paper, written and then forgotten about and then brought out at the next health and safety training day. If it's just part of your day-to-day activities.
And I think as a practice owner or leader or a head nurse or head vet or whatever your role is, it's very easy. And I think we've all done it, been in a situation where there's an SOP for sharps handling, for example. But particularly if you've done it for years and years and years your way, you kind of ignore that, particularly if you're the boss or you're somewhere else. And I think as an instruction to the team to say, here's the SOP that we look at once a year when Lucy comes to inspect us or have a look at the practice. But actually, when I'm really busy and stressed and I'm juggling a cup of tea and a dog, I do it this way. I think sends a message to the team that ignore that and copy what I do and sort of do as I say, do as I do rather than what I say sort of thing. So I think that's probably a cultural thing to embed into the practice. I go, if you're a leader in the practice, you don't have to do a song and dance about it as terms of I'm doing the SOP for this. But I think it's important you show the team that this is what I do on a day-to-day
basis. Lead by example.
Yeah, and that can be harder if you're an older practice owner that's done it a certain way and needs to get better.
And excellent, Stephen. You talked about culture there. So Chris, bringing you in, what helps, in your view, create a culture where staff feel comfortable raising concerns, asking questions or highlighting risks before they escalate?
Well, I don't think we can answer this question without referencing Amy Edmondson's psychological safety. For a start, we have to acknowledge we're all human beings, we're not infallible, and we're working in a very fast-paced and complex environment. And we need to be able to say, I made a mistake, I don't understand, I don't know. As we've touched on here, SOPs matter, but it's the culture that determines whether they're followed. People don't raise concerns because a policy exists, but because it feels right and safe to do so, especially when it's an uncomfortable one. So that means near misses are reported early, small risks are flagged before they escalate, and managers hear about problems whilst they're solvable. Now, the key factors for psychological safety, and Stephen touched on this very well as well, it starts at the top, really. It's leader behaviours and reactions. People take their cues from what leaders say and do when something goes wrong, not from the SOP. So the first response has to be calm, curious, problem solving, not looking to find out who's to blame, being defensive or panicking or something along those lines. Being clear, of course, that raising concerns is expected, and giving easy and practical routes for people to do that. Who to tell, what happens next, what feedback they will get and timescales and so on. A focus on learning and improvement rather than punishment. Visible follow through and closing the communications loop on anything that gets raised. Leading by example, which Stephen highlighted as well. So that means openly admitting your own mistakes and your own knowledge gaps, and realizing that all team members have equal rights to express themselves regardless of their job title. And this stuff isn't about being nice. It's about creating the conditions for honesty, learning and prevention. And you can do a short 10-question survey, for example, to give that to your team to find out how psychologically safe people feel.
Excellent. And I guess a question for all three of you then. If we were looking at a good communication and day-to-day leadership, what would those things look like in terms of embedding safer ways of working? So what does good communication and day-to-day leadership look like? I guess let's stay with you, Chris, if that's okay, please.
Sure. I quite like the idea of radical candor. If you show people that you care about them first and foremost, you can then build up so that people are accountable. And the perfect place to be is where people know you care about them and they're able to take accountability and you're able to challenge and they're able to challenge. Making sure you give sort of time and space for some of the quieter voices in the practice. Obviously, modelling appropriate behaviours, responding appropriately, following through that we touched on before, but also kind of looking at how you go about your stuff. Take a bit of a pause, invite challenge. You know, ask people what am I missing here? Who sees this differently from where I am? And don't assume that people being silent means that everything is fine. It's about sort of setting clear expectations, turning policies into lived practices, which we spoke about there. So as Stephen mentioned, you know, embedding this stuff. So it's this stuff is part of your regular check-ins, your one-to-ones, your team meetings, your huddles, your handovers, you know, asking questions like any near misses today, or using various frameworks that you can do it at different types of meeting. So it's not a special event, it's part of routines.
I think that's a really important question. I think, as you say, in terms of embedding it into the culture, part of it is having the avenues already available, whether that's huddles or team meetings or some facility which is sort of doesn't make it seem like it's a big event, that if you want to report an issue, you have to go to the big office and speak to the big boss, which is something that A, you're busy, and B, is a bit terrifying if you're a more junior person. But if there's an avenue, because you're having daily huddles, or you've got Slack, or you've got some system where you go, actually continuous improvement, or something where you go, there's an avenue for me to very easily ping and go, oh, this is needs fixing. And one of the aspects, I suppose, of that to help embed in the culture is it's very easy with health and safety sort of stuff, I think, for whoever spots it, to kind of literally slide it under the door of a manager and go, problem for you to fix. And I think a big part of that is that empowering of the team to go, well, you can, you know, everybody can fix it. There's a socket that doesn't work. You know who our electrician is. Here's the number to call them. You know, if this machine is leaking and it's through this company that fixes it, instead of saying, you know, passing it up a chain and then passing back down the chain to say, it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're a vet, a nurse, animal care assistant, here's the details. I give you the authority and permission to fix this problem, so that they sort of feel, again, it's embedded in it. It's not a one person specific role.
I really like your point as well about training, not seeing health and safety training as being a separate thing from training in other aspects, but weaving it in to your training so that it just becomes part of.
Because we do that in a lot of other areas, and I think probably for clinical areas, we're very natural because that's what we like and what we're trained to do, is we've, you know, merged different aspects of the clinical side of things and even the client care, customer service side of things. We're also getting better at weaving that all in. And I think you're absolutely right. If we can merge this in as well, it makes it just having far more and almost easier to do.
It's a culture. It's the way we do things.
It's just the way they do things. Yeah.
Just use simple everyday conversations rather than make it an event, like you said there. Don't overcomplicate it. Don't make it into a bigger thing that it needs to be. But at the same time, keeping its importance like you would with your clinical work.
And I think even with things like SOPs and things, we've all got them and we have to document a certain lot of things. Certainly, I think even the language we use can turn people off and make it feel like it's something big and scary, or something it's not for me, it's a management job, or anything like that at all. And even just changing our language, so instead of saying, look, there's an 24-page SOP on that, we go, this is the way we do it here. And we incorporate things like, actually, here's a video with a QR code on the machine that shows you how to use it. Yes, there is an SOP in that. You can read it if reading is your thing. But, you know, if you've got a phone and you've got 30 seconds, scan this and it shows you how to disinfect an infected patient or whatever.
Yeah, I think you can, if you can change the culture with the staff within the practice, that it's not a test and it's not it's not something they need to be worrying about. It is just part of what you do, and you just want to make sure that everybody's safe, themselves, the animals, you know, everybody in the practice is safe, and just make it as part of the day-to-day running of the practice.
Exactly. Part of that, I think, is making it, it's not a test that if you fail, there's some sort of punishment. We once did a thing whereby, again, to try and, how do you encourage people to say, bring up your problems? Well, we sort of went, it was a slightly different area in terms of pharmaceuticals, but we actually made a reward system where every time you spot a mistake, you come up here, there's a box of chocolates and you tell us what it is, what we can do about it, and here's a reward for it. And it just gamified it and turned it into a slightly fun thing rather than, oh, someone's going to be in trouble, but haha, this is a fun thing. And we spotted it. And it was amazing what a difference. People were very, almost overly keen, but in a good way, to say, here's an issue, what do we do about it? Rather than, just the person I need to speak to isn't here, I'll bury it.
If you completely take away that blame culture.
It's the blame punishment thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Superb. Well, I'm now going to move on to the last of the areas that I wanted to chat about, and I'm going to look at practical tools and resources, and I'll probably ask you, Lucy, to lead on this if that's okay. But to bring us to a close then, let's talk about solutions. So, Lucy, if we think about making health and safety easier for practice leaders and their teams, what practical tools or resources would make the biggest difference? Is it risk assessment templates, better training, clearer guidance, something else entirely?
I think it's probably all of those things. So I think anything that saves people time and removes any guesswork and makes it simpler is obviously going to have a positive impact on the practice. So risk assessment templates, like you said, just the starting point, because sometimes people can be overwhelmed. Where do we start? What should it say? What does it need to include? So just a bit of a bit of assistance with getting started can go a long way, just to take away that overwhelm at the start. I think it is the admin and the perceived complexity that can, again, get in the way. So anything that can reduce that. Training, I think there's different areas of different ways you can do the training. So if you could mix it up, I would say don't have all your training in one format, because it might not work for some people. Like you said, if you had a QR code with a video so people can watch something, or if you had some people that prefer to the visual learners, or they're better at reading things. So if you have the training in different formats so it works for everybody, I think that as well could.
Great. And I might get accused of leading the witness here, but I guess if I ask Chris and then Stephen, where can members of VMG, Chris, go if they want to find help in these areas?
Well, obviously, trusted partners such as yourselves at Citation, but also the HSE website itself has various basic risk assessment templates, some tools, and their basics pages are pretty good. But actually, it's quite complex stuff. And I think having somebody that can translate that for you into your veterinary practice, such as Citation, is really useful.
Great. And then similar question, Stephen, in terms of SPIVS members?
You know, we've been working in association with Citation since 2001. And so I think one of those, it is, as I say, there is some things that you can do, and a lot of practices will have done some of it themselves. I think the more you do and the more the practice grows, the more you realise the complexity of, like everything, you don't know what you don't know until you start to investigate it. So you can do some of that, and even work, you know, working with a partner like Citation, there are things you need to do with the practice to do the practice side of things. It is much easier when somebody can decipher the weekly newsletter or the thousands of things that come from the HSE to say, actually, this is relevant for you. Don't waste your time on 2 hours of other things, or here's something that another practice is good. You know, leading back to what you were saying, Lucy, it would be really useful for, I think, practices to know what other practices are doing to do that. You know, we see an HSE template of 50 pages from the government about what to do with this, but for to say, actually, here's how this would translate to your profession. This is what you could do. This would both tick the boxes and be practical, and I'm not wasting 5 hours of your time. So I think that's part of the big benefit of working with, you know, like you, if you have an animal that's unwell, you trust a veterinary surgeon to do it. If you've got health and safety issues or just need to manage the practice in a safe way, you logically would go to a partner that offers that.
Excellent. Well, look, thanks to the three of you. So for me to close the podcast, I guess HSE inspections can feel intimidating. Well, actually, they do feel intimidating and will probably continue to. But as we've discussed today, if you've got the right systems, team culture and preparation in place, they can actually help strengthen confidence and safety within your practice. So I'd like to say a huge thank you to my guests, Lucy Pottle, Chris White and Stephen Goodyear, for sharing their insight and experience. And to our listeners, if you're looking for help with audits, risk assessments, digital tools or ongoing compliance support, you'll find all the details in the show notes. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.